miraculously regains the sight in one eye. "It's comedy genius," announced Eunice, grinning as she handed the pages back to Bomber. "Are you sure you're not tempted to publish?" Bomber threw a rubber which just missed her head as she ducked. Eunice sat down at her desk and cupped her chin in her hands, lost in thought. "Why do you think she does it?" she asked Bomber. "I mean, she can't just do it to wind you up. It's too much effort. And anyway, knowing Portia, the joke would have worn thin by now. There has to be more to it than that. And if she wanted to, she could self-publish. She could certainly afford it." Bomber shook his head sadly. "I think that she genuinely wants to be good at something. Unfortunately, she's just picked the wrong thing. For all her money and so-called friends, I expect that hers is a pretty empty life sometimes." "I think, perhaps, that it's all about you." Eunice stood up again and strolled over to the window. She could order her thoughts better when she was moving. "I think she wants her big brother's approval, praise, love, validation, whatever you want to call it. And she's trying to earn it through writing. She's painted herself into a corner in every other way. She's rude, selfish, shallow, and sometimes downright cruel. And she'd never admit that she cares a flying fortress what you think of her. But she does. Deep down, your little sister just wants you to be proud of her. And she's chosen to write not because she has any talent or because it gives her any joy. It's a means to an end. You are a publisher, and she wants to write a book that you think good enough to publish. That's why she always borrows her plot lines from the classic greats." "But I do love her. I can't approve of the way she behaves, the way she treats Ma and Pa, and the way she talks to you. But she's my sister. I'll always love her." Eunice came and stood behind him and placed her hands gently on his shoulders. "I know that. But I don't think Portia does. Poor Portia." And for once, she meant it.
Chapter 34. Laura sat on the bed, her fists clenched so tightly that her fingernails bit crescents into the flesh of her palms. She didn't know whether to be frightened or furious. Al Bowley's voice drifted up from the garden room below, and his seductive tones were like fingernails scraping relentlessly down a blackboard. "Well, I'm sick at the very thought of you," she exploded, and launched the book from her bedside table violently across the room. It hit one of the glass candlesticks on the dressing table, which fell to the floor and smashed. "Bugger!" Laura made a silent apology to Anthony. She got up and went downstairs to fetch a dustpan and brush, and to check what she knew already to be absolutely, unarguably, indubitably true. The Al Bowley record was still in its faded paper cover in the middle of the table in the study. She had put it there herself only yesterday, sick of hearing the tune which now haunted her, quite literally, day and night. She had hoped, rather foolishly now it seemed, that if she physically removed the record from the vicinity of the gramophone player, it would stop. But Thérèse didn't have to play by those rules, physical rules. Her death had seemingly dispensed with such prosaic constraints, and she was free to make mischief in many more imaginative ways. And who or what else could it be? Anthony had been unfailingly kind to her while he was alive, so it was unlikely that he would take up such petty persecutions now he was dead. After all, Laura had done, or was trying to do, everything that he had asked of her. She picked up the record and looked at the smiling face of the man on the cover, with his slick black hair and his sultry dark eyes. "You have no idea," she told him, shaking her head. She put the record in a drawer and leaned back against it with all her weight, as though to emphasize its closing. As if that would make any difference. She had told Freddy about the door to Thérèse's room and asked him to see if he could get it open. He had tried the handle and declared the door to be locked, but then said that he didn't think they should do anything about it.
"She'll unlock it when she's ready,"
he had said, as though he were talking about a naughty child being left to exhaust a tantrum. Both Freddy and Sunshine seemed to accept Therese with an equanimity that Laura found infuriating. The troublesome presence of someone who was definitely dead and scattered in the garden should surely cause some consternation, particularly as she should by now, and thanks to their efforts, be existing somewhere in a state of postnuptial, although admittedly post-mortem, bliss. It was damned ungrateful. Laura smiled to herself ruefully. But who else could it be except Therese? Where reason fails, chimera flourishes. Just as she was finishing sweeping up the shards of broken glass, she heard Freddy and Carrot coming in from their walk. Downstairs in the kitchen over tea and toast, she told Freddy about the music.
Oh, that, he said, feeding bits of buttered toast to Carrot. I've heard it too, but I never take much notice. I never know whether it's sunshine or not.
I took the record away, but it made no difference. So now I've put it in a drawer in the study.
Why?
Said Freddy, stirring sugar into his tea. Why did I take it away, or why did I put it in the drawer?
Both.
Because it's driving me mad. I took it away so that she couldn't play it any more.
Who? Sunshine?
No. Laura paused for a moment, reluctant to say it out loud. Therese.
Ah, our resident ghost. So you took it away, which didn't work, and you thought that shutting it in a drawer might?
Not really, but it made me feel better. I keep wondering what else she might do. Why is she being such a bloody prima donna? She's got Anthony now, so what's the problem with me having the house? It's what he wanted. Freddy sipped his tea, frowning as he mulled over her question.
Remember what Sunshine said? She said that Therese wasn't cross with you. She was cross with everyone. Her ire is indiscriminate. So it isn't about the house. Did anything like this ever happen while Anthony was still alive?
Not as far as I know. There's always been that scent of roses in the house, and a vague sense that Therese was still about, but I never saw or heard anything definite, and Anthony didn't mention anything.
So it's only since Anthony died that Madam started playing up?
Yes, but that's what's so wrong about it. I always assumed that she'd been waiting for him somewhere in the ether or wherever for all these years, practicing her foxtrot or painting her nails. Freddy wagged his finger at her, gently admonishing the catty tone that had crept into her voice. I know, I'm being horrid. Laura laughed at herself. But honestly, what more does she want? She should be happy now she's got him back. Instead, she's hanging around here misbehaving like a disgruntled diva, deceased. Freddy put his hand over hers and squeezed it.
I know it's unsettling. She's certainly a bit of a live wire.
Especially for someone who's supposed to be dead, interrupted Laura. Freddy grinned.
I think you two might have got on rather well. From what Anthony told me about her, I reckon you're more alike than you realise.
He talked to you about Therese?
Sometimes, yes. Especially towards the end.
He drained his mug and refilled it from the teapot.
But maybe we're missing something here. We're assuming that just because Anthony's dead and we scattered him in the same place where he scattered Therese, they must be together. But are the ashes really what matters? Aren't they just remains? What's left behind when the person is gone? Anthony and Therese are both dead, but maybe they're not together and that's the problem. If you and I both went to London separately and didn't arrange a place to meet, what would be the likelihood of us ever finding one another? And let's face it, wherever it is that they've gone has to be a whole hell of a lot bigger than London, bearing in mind all the dead people who will have pitched up there since, well, since people started dying.
Freddy leaned back in his chair, looking rather pleased with himself and his explanation. Laura sighed and slumped back in her own chair despondently. So what you're saying is that Therese is actually worse off now than before he died, because at least then she knew where he was. Well, that's just marvellous. We could be stuck with her for years, forever. Bugger! Freddy came and stood behind her and placed his hands gently on her shoulders.
Poor Therese. I think you should put the record back in the garden room.
He kissed the top of her head and went out to work in the garden. Suddenly, Laura felt guilty. It was probably all nonsense, but just supposing it wasn't. She had Freddy now, but what if, after all this time, Therese still didn't have Anthony? Poor Therese. Laura got up and went to the study. She fetched the record from the drawer and took it back to the garden room, where she placed it on the table next to the gramophone player. Picking up the photograph of Therese, she gazed at the woman, now blurred and distant behind splintered glass. She saw, perhaps for the first time, the person behind the paper picture. Freddy might think that they were alike, but Laura could see the differences. She had already lived 15 years longer than Therese, but she had no doubt that Therese had lived her short life harder, brighter, faster than Laura ever had. What a waste. Laura gently ran her fingertips over the face behind the cruel mosaic. What was it that Sarah had said? It's time to stop hiding and start kicking life up the arse. I'll get you fixed, she promised Therese. Then she took up the record again and placed it on the turntable. Play nicely, she said out loud to the room. I'm trying to be on your side.
Chapter 35. Eunice. 1994. Eunice would never forget the scent of sun-warmed roses, wafting in through the open window as she sat with Bomber and Grace, watching Godfrey die. He was almost gone now. Just a worn-out body remained, barely ticking over, breaths too shallow to lift even a butterfly's wings. The fear and anger and confusion that had racked his last years had finally relinquished their tyranny over Godfrey and left him in peace. Grace and Bomber were able at last to hold his hands, and baby Jane snuggled in close to him, with her head gently resting on his chest. They had long since stopped trying to make conversation to fill the uncomfortable space between dying and death itself. Every now and then, a nurse would knock softly on the door, bringing tea and unspoken sympathy to a closing scene she had witnessed countless times before. Eunice got up and went over to the window. Outside, the afternoon was passing by without them. People were strolling in the gardens or snoozing in the shade, and a group of children were chasing one another across the lawns, squealing with delight. Somewhere, high in one of the trees, a thrush was scatting against the metronome tick of a sprinkler. Now would be a good time, she thought, to slip away on the coattails of a perfect English summer's afternoon. It seemed that Grace was in accord. She leaned back in her chair and exhaled a long sigh of resignation. Keeping hold of Godfrey's hand, she struggled to her feet, grudging joints stiff from too long sitting. She kissed Godfrey on the mouth and stroked his hair with a frail but steady hand. It's time, my love. It's time to let go. Godfrey stirred, but just barely. Translucent eyelids fluttered, and his weary chest rose for one final ragged breath. And then he was gone. Nobody moved except baby Jane. The little dog stood, and with infinite care, she sniffed every inch of Godfrey's face. Finally satisfied that her friend was gone, she jumped down from the bed, shook herself thoroughly, and sat down at Bomber's feet, looking up at him beseechingly with an expression that clearly said, "And now I really need a wee." An hour later they were sitting in what was called the relatives' room, drinking yet more tea. The relatives' room was the place where the Follies End staff gently shepherded people once they were ready to leave the newly deceased. Its walls were the colour of faded primroses, and the light was soft through muslin curtains, hung as a veil from prying eyes. With sofas plush and deep, fresh flowers and boxes of tissues, it was a room designed to cushion the sharp edges of raw grief. After a few initial tears, Grace had rallied and was ready to talk. In truth, she had lost the man she married long ago, and now with his death, at least she could begin to mourn. Mama was pale but composed, dabbing at the tears that occasionally leaked silently down his face. Before they had left Godfrey's room, he had kissed his father's cheek for the final time. He had then removed Godfrey's wedding ring from his finger for the first time since Grace had placed it there a lifetime ago. The gold was scratched and worn, the circle a little misshapen, a testament to a long and robust marriage, where love was rarely voiced, but manifest every day. Bomber had handed the ring to his mother, who slipped it onto her middle finger without a word. Then he had telephoned Portia. Grace came and sat next to Bomber and took his hand.
"Now, son, while we wait for your sister, I have something to say. You probably won't want me to talk about this, but I'm your mother, and I have to say my piece."
Eunice had no idea what was coming, but offered to leave them in private.
"No, no, my dear. I'm sure Bomber won't mind you hearing this, and I'd rather like you to back me up on this one, if you don't mind."
Eunice sat back down, intrigued. Baby Jane, who was sitting on the sofa next to Bomber, crawled onto his lap as though to lend moral support.
"Righto. Here goes."
Grace squeezed her son's hand and gave it a little shake.
"Darling, I've always known, since you were a little boy, that you were never going to be the sort of chap who got married and provided me with any grandchildren. I think that secretly your father knew that too, but of course we never spoke about it. Now, I want you to know that I don't give a jot about any of that. I've always been proud to have you as my son. And as long as you're happy and leading a decent life, well, that's all that matters."
Bomber's cheeks were growing very pink, although whether it was his tears or Grace's words that were to blame, Eunice couldn't tell. She was deeply moved by Grace's sentiments, but fighting a fit of the giggles at her peculiarly British way of trying to say something without actually saying it.
"Last week, Jocelyn took me to the cinema. It was supposed to be a little treat to take my mind off your father for a bit."
There was the tiniest catch in Grace's voice, but she swallowed hard and carried on.
"We didn't pay too much attention to what was on. Just bought the tickets and some mint imperials and went and sat down."
Baby Jane wriggled in Bomber's lap to get comfortable. This was taking a little longer than she had expected.
"The film was Philadelphia, with that nice Tom Hanks, Paul Newman's wife, and that Spanish fellow."
She thought carefully about her next words and finally settled upon,
"It wasn't very cheerful." She paused, hoping perhaps that she had said enough, but the puzzled expression on Bomber's face forced her to continue.
She sighed.
"I just want you to promise me that you'll be careful. If you find a special friend, or..."
The thought clearly just occurring to her.
"You have one already. Just promise me that you won't get hives."
Eunice bit down hard on her lip, but Bomber couldn't hold back a smile.
"It's HIV, Ma."
But Grace wasn't listening. She just wanted to hear him promise.
"I couldn't bear to lose you as well."
Bomber promised.
"Cross my heart and hope to die."
Chapter 36.
"It wasn't me, I promise," said Sunshine.
They had come into the study to put some more things onto the website and had found Anthony's treasured fountain pen lying in a pool of black ink in the middle of the table. It was a handsome Conway Stewart, and Sunshine had admired it many times, lovingly stroking its shiny scarlet and black surface before reluctantly returning it to its drawer. Laura saw the worried look on Sunshine's serious face and gave her a reassuring hug. "I know it wasn't, sweetheart." She asked Sunshine to rinse the pen carefully under the tap and then put it back where it belonged while she cleaned up the mess on the table. When Laura returned to the study after washing her ink-stained hands, Sunshine was busy choosing more things from the shelves.
"It was the Lady of the Flowers, wasn't it?" she asked Laura.
"Oh, I don't know about that," Laura bluffed. "Perhaps I left it there and forgot about it, and somehow it leaked." She knew how unlikely it sounded, and the expression on Sunshine's face confirmed that she was completely unconvinced. Laura had been thinking about what Freddy had said, and the more she thought about it, the more concerned she became. If all these things were Therese's doing, and a physical demonstration of her pain still being apart from Anthony, then surely the longer it went on, the worse it would get. She remembered Robert Quinlan's description of Therese as having a wild streak and a fiery temper when roused. Good God, at this rate she'd soon be setting fires and smashing up the place, and Laura was already a little tired of cleaning up after a grumpy ghost.
"We should try and help her," said Sunshine.
Laura sighed, slightly shamed by Sunshine's generosity of spirit. "I agree, but how on earth do we do that?" Sunshine shrugged her shoulders, her face crumpling into a perplexed frown.
"Why don't we ask her?" she eventually suggested.
Laura didn't want to be unkind, but it was hardly a practical suggestion. She wasn't about to hold a seance or buy a Ouija board on eBay. They spent the rest of the morning adding things to the website, while Carrot snored contentedly in front of the fire. After lunch, Sunshine and Freddy took Carrot for a walk, but Laura stayed behind. She was thoroughly unsettled. Normally, the task of entering data onto the website was a therapeutic distraction, but not today. She could only think about Therese. Like a creature whose fur has been brushed against the nap, her skin prickled and her thoughts skimmed and zigzagged like a water boatman across the surface of a pond. She needed to do something about Therese. There had to be what Jerry Springer and his fellow reality TV ringmasters called an intervention. If only she knew what the hell it ought to be. Outside, gauzy sunlight seeped through clear patches in a grey marbled sky. Laura took her jacket from the hall and went out into the garden for some air. In the shed, she found Freddy's secret packet of cigarettes and helped herself to one. She was only a high days and holidays smoker, really, but today she thought it might help. She wondered if Therese had smoked. As Laura strolled aimlessly round the rose garden, puffing like a guilty schoolgirl, Sunshine's words slipped back into her head. "Why don't we ask her?" It might not be very practical, but nothing about this whole situation was exactly run-of-the-mill, and there was no point in Laura trying to deal with it as though it were. So maybe Sunshine was right. If it was Therese doing all these things, and some days Laura clung on to that if, like a passenger on the Titanic to a life jacket, then leaving her to her own devices would only mean more and more trouble. Why don't we ask her? Laura was embarrassed even to be considering it. But what else could she do? Put up or shut up until... Laura didn't want to think about the possible endings to that sentence. She took a final puff on her cigarette, and then, glancing round furtively to make sure that she couldn't be seen or heard, she let her words escape out loud into the chill of the afternoon air. "Therese?" she began, just to clarify to whom she was talking. And just in case any other ghosts happened to be listening, she joked to herself. "You and I need to have a serious chat. Anthony was my friend, and I know how desperately he longed to be with you again. I want to help, and if I possibly can, I will. But wrecking the house, locking me out of my bedroom, and keeping me awake all night with your music isn't exactly appealing to my better nature. Clearly, ghostbusting isn't my area of expertise, so if you know how I can help, then you'll have to try and find a way of sharing that with me. Laura paused, not expecting an answer, but feeling somehow that she should leave a gap for one anyway. I don't have the patience for puzzles and riddles, and I'm hopeless at Cluedo, she continued. So you'll have to try and make it as clear and simple as you can, preferably without breaking or setting fire to anything. Or anyone, she added under her breath. Once again, she waited. Nothing, except for the cooing and canoodling of two amorous pigeons on the shed roof, practicing for spring. She shivered. It was getting colder. I mean what I said, Therese. I'll do whatever I can. She marched back down the garden, feeling a little foolish and in need of a cup of tea and a consoling chocolate biscuit. Back in the kitchen, she put the kettle on and opened the biscuit tin. Inside was Anthony's pen. Chapter 37. Well, if that's her idea of clear and simple, I dread to think what her cryptic would be like. Laura was walking hand in hand with Freddy, and they were mulling over the mystery of Anthony's pen. Carrot was trotting along in front of them, sniffing and marking his territory at alternate lampposts. They had been to the Moon Is Missing for a few drinks. Freddy had thought it might take Laura's mind off Therese for a bit, but the entire cast of Blithe Spirit was reliving the triumph of their first night in the bar. Marjorie Wadscallop was still in full Madame McCarthy hair and makeup, and wasted no time in pointing out to Winnie the arrival of Laura and Freddy together. It had hardly been the quiet drink that Freddy had been hoping for.
Are you sure that Sunshine put the pen back in the drawer?
Well, I didn't actually see her do it, but I'm sure she would have. Why? You don't think she's playing games, do you? Freddy smiled and shook his head.
No, I don't. I really don't. Sunshine's probably the most honest out of all of us, including you, he said to Carrot, as he clipped the lead to his collar, ready to cross the road.
Back at Padua, Laura poured them both another drink, and Freddy livened up the fire that was barely smouldering in the garden room.
Now, said Freddy, snuggling up to Laura on the sofa, let's see if the wine has aroused our deductive juices.
Laura giggled. That sounds positively smutty. Freddy raised his eyes in feigned surprise and took a swig from his glass.
Right. Let's look at the clue again. A pen in a biscuit tin.
Not just any pen, Anthony's best, beloved Conway Stewart fountain pen, red and black marbled shaft with an 18-carat gold nib, Laura added.
Thank you, Miss Marple, but does that really help our investigation?
Well, it was the pen that Anthony used to write his stories. They sat in contemplative silence, listening to the spit and crackle of the fire. Carrot groaned blissfully as he stretched his spindly legs nearer to the hearth. Freddy nudged him with his toe.
Watch it, mister. If you get any closer, you'll roast your toes.
Carrot ignored him and wriggled infinitesimally nearer.
Have you read all of Anthony's stories? Maybe the clue is in one of them.
Laura shook her head. I told her I wasn't any good at clues. I specifically asked her to make it clear and simple. Freddy drained his glass and set it down on the floor.
Well, maybe it is clear and simple to her.
Laura resisted the temptation to point out that of course it was, because Therese already knew the answer. I read everything he asked me to type, obviously, and certainly all of the short stories, but that was years ago now. I can't possibly remember all of them.
What about that book you showed me? The collection of short stories?
That was only the first of several that were published. I suppose he must have kept copies of the others somewhere, but I don't remember seeing them. Freddy grinned.
I bet they're in the attic.
Why? Freddy pulled the face that Sunshine always pulled when she thought that they were being particularly obtuse.
Because that's where everyone always puts the stuff they don't know what else to do with, he said triumphantly. Although if I'd had a book published, I'd have it on my bookshelf in pride of place.
Laura thought about it for a moment. But he wasn't proud of all the short stories that were published. Remember, I told you. His publisher wanted insipid, simple, happy ever afters, and they fell out over it in the end. Freddy nodded.
I do remember. Bruce wanted lemonade, and Anthony gave him absinthe.
Laura smiled. You would remember that. Anything to do with alcohol, she teased. But I suppose it's worth a try. I haven't really had a proper look in the attic, and even if the books aren't there, there might be something else.
Tomorrow, said Freddy, standing up and dragging her to her feet. We'll look tomorrow.
He kissed her firmly on the lips.
Now, what was that you said about being smutty?
Laura woke with a jolt that broke her fall. Was she dreaming about falling or falling out of the dream? She could never tell. It was still dark, and the silence was barely rippled by the hushed duet of Freddy and Carrot's breathing. The back of Freddy's warm hand rested on the outside of her thigh, and as her eyes grew accustomed to the dark, she could just about make out the rise and fall of his chest. She wondered what Anthony would think. She hoped he would approve, be pleased for her. After all, he had told her to be happy, and she was, mostly. She still worried about returning the lost things. The website was coming along nicely, thanks to Freddy, and though her fear of failing Anthony was deeply rooted in the fertile tract of her self-doubt, now courage grew alongside. Finally, she had found the guts to try. Therese was a constant shadow, but the general sweep of her life, the day-to-day at Padua, was definitely happy. Oh, and of course she worried about Freddy. But surely that was an occupational hazard in a new relationship, particularly at her age. She worried that he hadn't yet seen the full horror of her treacherous stretch marks and her crow's feet in the unforgiving glare of the midday sun. She worried that he might not yet have noticed the insidious creep of cellulite crumpling her once pert bottom and threatening her thighs. And she was sorry, too, that Freddy had not seen her bottom at the peak of its pertness. Instead, it had been wasted on Vince. If only she had met Freddy when she was young. Younger, even. If only she had married Freddy. She smiled to herself at her foolishness and then stopped, mindful of the crow's feet, and vowed to wear enormous sunglasses and a wide-brimmed hat should she ever be foolish enough to venture outside in the sunlight again. And she wasn't even going to think about the menopause. The clue was in the name, wasn't it? But not so much a pause as a bloody great full stop as far as being remotely attractive to men was concerned. She was even breaking out in a sweat not thinking about it. She turned her pillow over and buried her face in the cool, fresh cotton. Get a grip, Laura, she told herself. She reached for Freddy's hand and took it in her own. Instinctively, he squeezed it, and Laura lay there in the darkness, blinking away the tears until eventually she drifted back to sleep. Things always look better in the morning. It wasn't the sunlight that poked fun at Laura's imperfections, but the darkness with its looming doubts that mocked her in the sleepless spells that broke the night. After breakfast, she went out into the garden, hatless, and squinted into the morning sun. Freddy had gone into town, and she was going up into the attic. She fetched the stepladder from the shed and carted it upstairs with some difficulty. Carrot had decided to help by running up and down the stairs, barking excitedly in an attempt to ward off the invasion of the clanking, rattling metal legs that were clearly an instrument of the devil. As Laura propped the fully extended ladder against the wall, she could already hear Freddy scolding her for not waiting.
"We'll do it when I get back," he had said.
But she was too impatient to wait. Besides, Sunshine would be here soon, and she was perfectly capable of calling an ambulance. As she pushed open the hatch into the attic, the musty smell of warm dirt and dust wafted out to greet her. She flicked on the light switch, and at once her hand was sticky with cobwebs. Where to start? There were a few bits of old furniture, a large rug rolled into a sausage, and a variety of boxes. She lifted the lids on those closest to her. They contained general household flotsam and jetsam, an unused tea service, a canteen of silver-plated cutlery, and various pieces of useless but decorative china. One contained books, but as far as she could see, none had been written by Anthony. Laura made her way cautiously across the joists, stooping awkwardly under the pitch of the rafters. A child's push-along horse on wheels stood lonely in a corner next to a large brown cardboard suitcase and a box from a dressmaker in London. Laura stroked the soft teddy bear fur of the horse's nose. "Well, you're not staying up here," she promised him. The suitcase was thick with dust, but not locked, and a quick peek inside told Laura that it was probably her best hope of finding something useful or interesting. She clipped its rust-freckled fasteners shut and dragged it over to the hatch. How on earth was she going to get it down? It was heavy, and she doubted if she could manage its weight and the ladder at the same time. The answer, of course, was to wait for Freddy, but if she did that, she might just as well have waited for him before going up there. Perhaps she could just let it slide down the ladder on its own. It looked pretty robust, and from what she had seen, it didn't appear to contain anything breakable. The slide down the ladder turned out to be more of a sheer drop. As Laura let it go, it crashed onto the landing with an almighty thump and an explosion of dust. Laura went back for the horse, which was light enough for her to carry down the ladder. Having given him a softer landing than the suitcase, she went back up and fetched the box from the London dressmaker. By the time Freddy returned, the ladder was back in the shed. Sunshine was in the garden brushing the dust out of the horse, and Laura had the suitcase open on the table in the study and was going through the contents. There were several old photograph albums with thick pages the colour of dark chocolate interleaved with crispy embossed tissue papers, a couple of typed manuscripts, and some letters and assorted paperwork. The albums contained the first years of Anthony's life long before Therese. A curly-haired toddler sat, legs splayed, on a tartan rug in a summer garden. A sturdy little boy rode astride a push-along horse on a neatly clipped lawn. A gangling youth with a shy grin wore oversized shin pads and wielded a cricket bat. It was all there. A parade of seaside holidays, country picnics, birthdays, christenings, weddings and Christmases. At first, they were three, but then only two. The tall, dark man, so often in uniform, disappeared from their pictures as he did from their lives. Laura carefully unhooked one of the photographs from the brown paper corners that fixed it into the album. The man stood straight-backed and proud, so very handsome in his dress uniform. His arm was wrapped fondly round the shoulder of the woman, soignée in a Schiaparelli evening gown. And between them was a little boy wearing his pyjamas. A picture-perfect happy family. The very thought of you. Laura could hear the music playing in her head. Or perhaps it was in the garden room. She wasn't always sure these days that she could tell the difference. This was the photograph. The evening that Robert Quinlan had described when he had come to read the will. This was the last time that Anthony had seen his father. The last dance, the last kiss, the last photograph. She would put it in a silver frame beside the photograph of Therese in the garden room.
Found anything interesting yet?
Freddy had brought her a cup of coffee and a sandwich. He rummaged around in the suitcase beneath the papers and took out a small velvet-covered box.
Aha! What's this? Hidden treasure?
He flipped open the lid to reveal a white gold ring set with an exquisite star sapphire and sparkling diamonds. He set it down in front of Laura, who took it out of the box and held it up to the light. The star across the cabochon of cornflower blue was clearly visible. It was hers, her engagement ring.
How do you know?
Freddy took it from her to inspect it more closely.
It could have been Anthony's mother's.
No, it was hers, I'm sure. Therese wasn't a humdrum diamond solitaire type of woman, she said, smiling ruefully at the thought of her own half-carat set in 9-carat gold. She was, by all accounts, extraordinary. Like this ring. Freddy slipped it back into the velvet box and handed it to Laura.
Well, it's yours now.
Laura shook her head. It will never be mine. Freddy went outside to help Sunshine. He had promised to give the horse's wooden hooves a fresh coat of varnish. Laura continued emptying the contents of the suitcase onto the table. She found a bill of sale for 50 rosebushes. Albertine, 4. Grand Prix, 6. Marcia Stanhope, Mrs. Henry Morse, Etoile de Hollande, Lady Gay. The list went on. And a pamphlet on how to plant and care for them. The manuscripts were collections of Anthony's short stories that Laura had typed. As she flicked through the pages, she recognized them. Attached to the front was a harsh rejection letter from Bruce, the publisher.
Entirely inappropriate for our readership. Unnecessarily complex and self-indulgently ambiguous. Dark and depressing subject matter.
Someone had scribbled across the insulting comments with a red pen and written "arse" over Bruce's extravagant signature. It was Anthony's handwriting. Quite right, too, Laura agreed. She would reread the manuscripts thoroughly later, but somehow she didn't think they would contain the answer she was looking for. There was a rattle of metal wheels across the hall floor, and Sunshine entered the study pushing the horse, followed by Freddy and a curious carrot. "He looks like a different horse," Laura exclaimed, and Sunshine grinned proudly.
"He's called Sue."
Laura looked at Freddy to see if he could provide an explanation, but he simply shrugged his shoulders. Sue it was, then. Sunshine was eager to examine the contents of the suitcase and was spellbound by the ring. As she slipped it onto her middle finger, turning it this way and that to catch the sparkles, Laura had an idea. Perhaps it's the ring Therese wants us to find. Maybe that's what it's all about. Freddy was uncertain.
But what's the connection with the pen?
Laura ignored the flaw in her argument. Instead, warming to her theory, she said, "It was her engagement ring, don't you see? It's all about their connection, the bond between them. That's what an engagement is." Freddy was still doubtful.
"But so is a wedding, and that didn't work when we gave them one."
The face that Sunshine was pulling clearly showed that not only was she totally unconvinced, but she thought that they were both being particularly obtuse once again.
"The pen was for the clue. That means writing," she said.
She picked up the photograph of Anthony and his parents.
"That's why she plays the music," she said, handing Freddy the picture.
It was his turn to look to Laura for an explanation. "It's Anthony and his parents. Robert Quinlan told us about it. His parents were going out one evening while his father was home on leave, and he came down to say goodnight and found them dancing to the Al Bowley song. It was the last time he saw his father before he was killed."
"And then when Saint Anthony met the Lady of the Flowers," Sunshine was eager to tell the rest of the story, "he told her all about it, and so she danced with him in the convent gardens to stop him being sad."
She twisted the ring, which was still on her finger, and added, "And now we have to find a way to stop her being sad." "Well, I think the ring's worth a try," said Laura, holding out her hand to Sunshine, who reluctantly took it off and gave it to her. "We'll put it in the garden room next to her photograph. Now, where shall we put this splendid steed?" she added, in an attempt to distract Sunshine. But Sunshine had seen the box from the dressmaker and carefully removed the lid. Her gasp of astonishment drew both Laura and Freddy to her side. Laura lifted from the box a stunning dress made of cornflower blue silk chiffon. It had clearly never been worn. Sunshine stroked the delicate fabric lovingly. "It was her wedding dress," she said, almost in a whisper. "It was the Lady of the Flowers' wedding dress." Freddy was still holding the photograph.
"What I don't understand is why all these things were shoved into a suitcase and hidden away in the attic. It seems to me these were some of the things that must have been most precious to him. The ring, the photo, the dress, the beginnings of the rose garden, even the manuscripts. He stood by them, refusing to change them, and so he must have been proud of them."
Sunshine traced circles in the dust on the lid of the suitcase.
"They made him hurt too much," she said simply.
Carrot poked his head round the door of the study and whined. It was time for his tea.
"Come on," said Laura. "Let's put the ring and the dress in the garden room and find a home for this horse."
"Sue," said Sunshine, following behind Laura and Freddy. "And it's not the ring, it's the letter."
But Laura and Freddy had already gone.
Chapter 38, Eunice, 1997.
"I'm damn sure the ruddy man's doing it just to be bloody awkward." Bruce flounced across the office and flung himself into a chair like the tragic heroine of a silent black-and-white film. Eunice quite expected him to raise the back of his hand to his forehead to better illustrate his anguish and frustration. He had arrived uninvited and begun his rant before he had even reached the top of the stairs. "Steady the buffs, old chap," said Bomber, fighting to keep his amusement from contaminating his platitudes. "You'll do yourself an unpleasantness." Baby Jane perched majestically on a new faux fur cushion, gazed at Bruce, and concluded that his presence was unworthy of any acknowledgement. "Would you like a cup of tea?" Eunice asked him through gritted teeth. "Only if it's accompanied by a large whisky," Bruce retorted rudely. Eunice went to put the kettle on anyway. "Now, what's brought all this on?" Bomber was genuinely interested to find out who had managed to infuriate Bruce so thoroughly. Bruce's hair, in the style of Barbara Cartland, but the colour and consistency of cobwebs, quivered his indignation. "Damn that Anthony Purdue! Damn and blast the man to hell!" Bomber shook his head. "I say, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? Unless, of course, he's passed the port to the right or ravished your only daughter." When first confronted by a man as camp as Bruce, Eunice had assumed that he was gay. But Bruce was married to a large German woman with Zeppelin breasts, and the suggestion of a moustache who bred fancy mice and entered them into mouse shows. Astonishingly, Bruce and Brunhilde had managed to produce offspring, two boys and a girl. It was one of life's great mysteries, but not one upon which Eunice was inclined to dwell. "He's gone completely round the bend," expostulated Bruce, "deliberately writing the kind of subversive codswallop he knows I won't publish, full of dark deeds and weird endings, or no proper endings at all. I suppose he thinks it's clever or fashionable or some sort of catharsis for his personal grief, but I'm not having any of it. I know what normal, decent people like, and that's good, straightforward stories with a happy ending where the baddies get their comeuppance, the guy gets the girl, and the sex isn't too outré." Eunice plonked a cup of tea down in front of him, deliberately splashing some of the dishwater-coloured liquid from the cup into the saucer. "So You don't think that any of your readers might like to be challenged at all? Flex their intellectual muscles, so to speak, form their own opinions or extrapolate their own conclusions for once? Bruce lifted the cup to his lips and then, seeing its contents close up, changed his mind and set it down again with an irritated clatter. My dear, the readers like what we tell them they will like. It's as simple as that. Then why can't you tell them to like Anthony Perdue's new stories? Bomber kept the touche under his breath. Just. Anthony Perdue, wasn't he the chap whose collection of stories did rather well for you? Bruce raised his eyebrows so high in exasperation that they disappeared into his cobweb coiffure. For God's sake, Bomber, do try and keep up. That's what I've been saying. The first lot did really well. Happy stories, happy endings, happy bank balances all round. But not any more. He's gone from The Sound of Music to The Midwich Cuckoos. But I've drawn the line. I've told him it's either doe a deer or out on your ear. Bruce had once worked from offices in the same building as Bomber, and still visited for a free cup of tea and a gossip if he was passing. However, failure to enlist Bomber in his condemnation of the villainous Anthony Perdue and scant sympathy from Eunice meant that on this occasion Bruce's visit was a short one. "I wish we'd managed to sign poor Anthony before Bruce did," sighed Bomber. "I liked his first collection, but his new stories sound intriguing. I wonder if I should try a spot of poaching." Eunice took a small parcel from the drawer in her desk and handed it to Bomber. It was wrapped in thick charcoal grey paper and tied with a bright pink ribbon. "I know it's not your birthday until next week." Bomber's face lit up like a small boy's. He loved surprises. "But I thought that after a visit from Bruce the Bogeyman, you could do with cheering up." It was a copy of The Birdcage. They had been to see it on Bomber's birthday the previous year, and he had laughed so hard that he had almost choked on his popcorn. "I wish Ma could have seen it," he had said. "It's a damn sight more cheerful than Philadelphia." Grace had been dead for 18 months now. She had survived Godfrey by just over a year, and then died suddenly but peacefully in her sleep at Folly's End. She had been buried next to Godfrey in the grounds of the church, where they had been members of the congregation, and stalwarts of the flower-arranging team, and the summer fete and harvest supper committees for almost half a century. As Bomber and Eunice had stood side by side in the sun and shade-dappled churchyard on the day of Grace's funeral, their thoughts had turned to their own leaving ceremonies. "I'm for burning, not burial," declared Bomber. "Less room for error," he added. "And then I want you to mix my ashes with Douglas's and Baby Jane's, providing, of course, that I outlive her, and scatter us somewhere fabulous." Eunice watched as the funeral party wandered slowly back to their cars. "What makes you so sure that you'll die before me?" Bomber took her arm as they too began to make their way out of the churchyard. "Because you're a good few years younger than me and you've led a purer life." Eunice snorted her contention, but Bomber continued, "And because you're my faithful assistant, and you must do as I command." Eunice laughed. "Somewhere fabulous isn't a very specific command." "When I think of somewhere specific, I'll let you know." Just before they reached the lich gate, Bomber had stopped and squeezed her arm. "And one more thing." He had held her in his gaze with eyes that shone with unspilled tears. "Promise me that if I ever end up like Pa, mad as a box of frogs and stuck away in a home, that you'll find a way to, you know what, get me out." Eunice had forced a smile, though at that moment someone walked across her grave. "Cross my heart and hope to die," she had told him. Now Bomber showed his present to Baby Jane, but once she had ascertained that it was inedible and didn't squeak or bounce, she lost what little interest she had mustered. "So, what do you want to do for your birthday?" Eunice asked, twirling the pink ribbon around her fingers. "Well," said Bomber, "how about combining my birthday with our usual annual outing?
Eunice grinned. Brighton it is.
Chapter 39. It's not the ring, and now Therese is sulking. Laura kicked one of Carrot's many tennis balls across the lawn in frustration. Freddy stopped digging and leaned on his spade, ready to commiserate as required. Laura had come out into the garden, where Freddy was digging compost into the rose garden, with little purpose other than to vent her frustration. Freddy grinned at her.
Never mind. We'll sort it out eventually.
Laura was in no mood for platitudes. Therese and Sunshine were both sulking, no doubt for very different, but for the moment, equally unfathomable reasons. She was running behind with the data input for the website, and Carrot had got completely overexcited when the new postwoman had called to deliver a parcel and had weed on the Chinese rug in the hall. She took another petulant swing at a tennis ball, missed, and nearly fell over. Freddy resumed his digging in order to disguise his laughter. Laura had had high hopes that the sapphire ring might be the perfect panacea. She had replaced the broken glass in Therese's photograph, placed the picture of Anthony and his parents beside it, and the ring in its box in front of her. She had even tried to play the Alboli song for her.
How do you know that Therese is sulking?
Freddy had recovered himself sufficiently by now to try to be helpful. Because the bedroom door's still locked, and because of that damn record. Freddy frowned.
But I can't remember hearing it for days now.
Laura raised her eyebrows in exasperation. For God's sake, Freddy, do try and keep up. That's what I've been saying. Freddy ditched the spade and came and gave her a hug.
Well, not very clearly, I'm afraid. I'm not very good at clues. You'll have to make it clear and simple, he said, bracketing the phrase in the air with his fingers.
Touché, Laura grinned in spite of herself.
Right, said Freddy. How does Therese not playing dear old Al signify that she's sulking?
Because now, instead of playing it morning, noon and night, she won't allow it to be played at all. Freddy looked sceptical.
I'm not sure I understand.
Laura sighed. I've tried to play it over and over, but it simply won't. At first, I did it to be nice. I set up the photographs and the ring, and then, as a finishing touch, I thought I'd play the music, their song. But it won't play. She won't let it. Freddy chose his next words very carefully.
Well, it is an old record and an old player. Maybe the needle needs changing, or the record has been scratched.
One look at Laura's face was enough to derail his argument.
Okay, okay, you've checked. Of course you have. They're both fine.
Laura picked up yet another tennis ball and threw it at him, but this time with a laugh. Oh, God, I'm sorry. I'm such a grumpy cow, but I'm doing my best to help her, and now she's just being bloody awkward. Come on, I'll make you a cup of tea. There might even be a chocolate biscuit if Sunshine hasn't finished them. Freddy took her hand.
I shan't raise my hopes.
In the kitchen, Sunshine had just put the kettle on.
Perfect timing, said Freddy. We just came in for the lovely cup of tea.
Sunshine set out two more cups and saucers in ominous silence as Freddy washed his hands at the sink.
Are there any chocolate biscuits left?
He asked her with a wink. An unsmiling Sunshine placed the biscuit tin in front of him without a word and then turned away to watch the kettle boil. Freddy and Laura exchanged puzzled glances and then began discussing the progress of the website. They had decided that in order to create more interest, people who claimed back their lost possessions could post their stories on the website if they wanted to. Freddy had come up with an online form people had to complete, giving very specific details of where and when they lost whatever it was that they were claiming. The website simply displayed a photograph of each item, the month and year, and the general location where it had been found. The specific details on Anthony's labels were withheld in order for them to be sure that the people who came forward were the legitimate owners. Laura still